Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
This is Ryan Hereford, everybody.
Hi, Ryan. Thank you for being here. Thank you for allowing me to be here. Can you hear me? Okay, thanks. My brief talk today offers only a very small contribution to this growing body of work contesting, reimagining the stakes, paradigms, and grounds upon which we discuss extinction. Grounds which can oftentimes feel overwhelming, suspiciously totalizing in their scalar dissonance. In turn, my talk is only going to explore a question with no intention of any answer. It's a question raised by the poet Amnor Bese Philip, what is the word for bringing bodies back from water? Asked now amidst this melting ice, these rising tides, Philip's question, with its focus on retrieval, recollection, recovery, may seem at odds with the many contemporary aesthetic depictions of our watery worlds as looming, anticipatory, future-oriented threats. From former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed's sensational cabinet meeting with government ministers held 20 feet beneath the Indian Ocean, to Jeff Orlovsky's time-lapse videos of crumbling Arctic glaciers, aquatic representation finds itself front and center in the imagined future nows of anthropogenic climate change, where slowly deteriorating shorelines evoke what Rob Nixon famously called the slow violence of environmental catastrophe, highlighting disasters that are slow-moving, long in the making, anonymous, attritional, of indifferent interest to the sensation-driven technologies of our image-saturated world. As many eco-critics have noted, the lived realities of environmental crises today urgently challenge us to look beyond the pastoral nostalgia of a green humanities and shift our focus toward a blue cultural studies, where the otherworldliness and uninhabitability of oceanic metaphor might serve as better preparation for the dynamism of these uncertain species futures. Steve Mentz refers to such a practice as a swimmer poetics. And Mentz writes, to imagine a swimmer poetics for our storm-filled world can generate unsustainable but engaging narratives. Swimmers live in the world and enjoy it, but being in the water means knowing that stability cannot last. As the visible catastrophes of climate change appear, we recognize ourselves in the swimmer more than in the gardener. Such thinking does mark an important shift from the stasis of earthbound linearity to a chaotic and unbalanced fluctuation where dreams of ecological stability are sacrificed for a more nuanced understanding of our relation to change. Yet this celebration of the swimmer reiterates and naturalizes a universalism no different from the earlier environmental writings it seeks to challenge, invoking a species we that obscures or renders obsolete the differently allocated forms of violence, privilege or loss imbued in our aquatic relations. The question that Philip asks, what is the word for bringing bodies back from water, comes not from a shared sense of risk or impermanence, but rather a distinct and particular understanding, drawn from her epic poem titled after the 1781 ship Zong, which casts over 130 enslaved human beings into the sea for insurance reclamation. Philip's question reconfigures the poet Amiri Baraka's earlier reminder that at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there lies a railroad made of human bones. It envisions the rapid, devastating disruption of life worlds, not as future prospect, but as that which continues to be inherited by those surviving the accumulative wakes of colonization, displacement, genocide. The bodies after which Philip asks are specifically black bodies, and the water is specifically ocean water. The Atlantic, where forced passage unmade or extinguished life worlds, dissolved by the belly of the boat, what Edouard Glissant called, quote, a non-world from which you cry out, a womb abyss. Abyss, the word which Glissant assigns to both ocean depths as well as the hold of the ship, is what he calls a tautology, where, quote, the entire ocean, the entire sea gently collapsing in the end into the pleasures of sand, makes one vast beginning, but a beginning whose time is marked by these balls and chains gone green. The womb abyss of the ocean and the ship constitute a social death and a fugitive persistence, which would ontologically figure as blackness in the modern world, as well as a modern world born through its relation to anti-blackness. Whereas scholars like Saidiya Hartman, Fred Moten, and Jonathan Howard have all noted, slaves in the hold could be understood to constitute the ground upon which whiteness could originally stand and purport to be. This Atlantic abyss, this beginning of life worlds predicated on extinction, reminds us that the present epochal predicaments against which we are faced unevenly and equally have not been caused by all ways of knowing, being, and participating in our shared world. My work then for this collection thus rests on the preliminary assertion that what is at stake in a vast majority of speculative writings about our imposed existential crises is not the human at the species level so much as one particular figuration of being, what Sylvia Winter has referred to as the human as man with a capital M. And those of you that were here yesterday to see Catherine's wonderful presentation were offered, I think, a very important genealogy of Winter's discussion. Many anticipatory conversations about extinction not only hearken to species collapse, but are likewise born from anxieties about the end of whiteness as a prescribed and naturalized form of life, with all of its entailed pillars of displacement and genocide, colonization, human enslavement. This is certainly not a new assertion, and I am indebted to much recent work in decolonial scholarship and anti-racist environmental justice, produced in part by many individuals speaking at this symposium. And again, I think as we reflect on the really wonderful presentations in the last few days so far, what I've been saying is in some ways partially an echo. For my own contribution as a literary and cultural studies scholar working and teaching in a department provisionally called English, I am interested in the ways by which words, lyric, narrative, and other semantic forms might tell about extinction, not as speculative imagining, but as a process of recovery, recuperation, a commitment to hear voices that cannot be translated into the language of man. What Philip refers to in Zong as the inability to tell the story that must be told, and what Glissant likewise calls a clamor for the right to opacity. Poetry, I hope to argue briefly today, with its capacity to estrange language, to render words apart from their socially coded automations, to, in the words of Audre Lorde, give name to the nameless so it can be thought, might help us better address Philip's question, and in so doing come to tell about extinction as a fight for justice, a recuperation of life worldings, possibilities and pathways before and also beyond the end of man. In the concluding section of Zong, titled Notanda, Philip expands this earlier question. She writes, months later, I do an internet search for a word or phrase for bringing someone back from underwater that has as precise a meaning as the unearthing contained within the word exhume. I find words like resurrect and sub-aquatic, but not ex aqua. Does this mean that unlike being interred, once you're underwater, there is no retrieval, that you can never exhume from water? The gravestone or tombstone marks the spot of internment, whether of ashes or the body. What marks the spot of sub-aquatic death? Philip's lament raises questions about the use of spatial coordinates and seemingly stable geographic landmarks to accurately testify to departed lives, historical happenings. Writers and artists who seek to enmesh human memory, social time within patterns of the sea face such unique concerns where, unlike rock, clay, soil, the perpetual movement of waves and tidal currents diffract or even nullify the ocean's witness to lived experience, the implotment of collective stories. For the poet and theorist Christina Sharp, there is nevertheless a unique poetics of the sea that might address these inconsistent rhythms, dispersed spatial coordinates of diasporic loss, what she calls the wake or wake work, requiring attention to the word's multiple meanings as a current cast by ships, moving objects, bodies, as a ritual performed in collective grieving, as the opening of one's eyes, the coming into consciousness. Drawing from the deep scales of what environmental scientists call the residence time, between when a substance enters and leaves the ocean, which in the case of human blood can last over 260 million years, Sharp writes of, quote, those Africans who passed through the doors of no return and did not survive the holding in the sea, who are in hydrogen and oxygen and carbon and phosphorus and iron and sodium and chlorine in the time of the wake known as residence time. Bodies dispersed into oceanic residence cannot be recalled as individuated loss. No tombstone marks or names alive, but project across a timescape of extinction. Atlantic currents rising ever near cities and home places are no prequel to mass death, but rather bring the genocidal violence upon which such worlds were built closer to shore. Zong, which Philip notes was told to her by the spirit of Satayi Adamu Boateng, an ancestral griot whose revelations the poet recovers rather than composes, further extends the spectral liquid porosity of residence time as a disembodied voice whose wave-like rhythms take shape within an ever-present, always encroaching now. I'm giving you these long quotes on the board as well, too, so you can spend time with them independently. Our entrance to the past is through memory, either oral or written, and water. In the case of salt water, in this case salt water, seawater, and as the ocean appears to be the same yet is constantly in motion, affected by tidal movements, so too this memory appears stationary yet is shifting always. Repetition drives the event and the memory simultaneously, becoming a haunting, becoming spectral in its nature. Oceanic memorial is thus not a marker, but a movement, a ghostly, unexpected arrival of past contradictions, rearranged and repeated across vast horizons of time. How might poetry as a cultural form attend to such patterns of the sea? In Zong, loss is attritional. The rhythmic and spatial assemblage of particular repetitions, including the long gaps of silent, blank space between, creates an ocean of words, dispersed, diffracted, and rearranged across textual currents. Dissolving the word water, Philip evokes the contradictory needs of dying, dehydrated persons, at the same time imminent of a fearful threat of being cast into the sea. And they're broken spread across the page, these individuated letters, disinterred from their attached meaning, reorient readers to the spatial relations of Zong, where repetition replicates tidal rhythms familiar yet simultaneously illegible to any fixed method of decipherment. The English word water, for instance, dissipates and reemerges in other variants like want, away, huan. When enmeshed with the current of other letters, it becomes one day, good, go. Read in Yoruba, we find phrases like o daabo, until my your return, o daola, until tomorrow. Philip C. is not some a priori essence whose representation the poet strives to render in accuracy, but an experience of reading, a submersion in chalk, kaolin clay, bromine, and all the other elements composing material bodies of the book. Additionally, with words like in, water, and to be, as three of the most repeated signs and phrasings in Zong, Philip's lyric seascape is inextricably linked to ontology, to ways and modes of being human, as performed and naturalized, estranged or reimagined by submersion in aquatic assemblage. Philip describes this oceanic decomposition of words and semantics as an act of violence, not dissimilar from the historical traumas recounted in Zong. She writes, I murder the text, I literally cut it into pieces, castrating verbs, suffocating adjectives, murdering nouns, throwing articles, prepositions, conjunctions overboard, jettisoning adverbs. I separate subject from verb, verb from object, create semantic mayhem until my hands bloodied from so much killing and cutting, reach into the stinking, eviscerated innards, and like some seer, sangoma, or prophet who, having sacrificed an animal for signs importance of new life, or simply life, reads the untold story that tells itself by not telling. The text that Philip murders in Zong is a legal body, specifically the recorded transcript from the Court of the King's Bench hearings on May 21st and 22nd, 1783, titled Gregson v. Gilbert. The case of the slave ship Zong, originally named Zorg, meaning care in Dutch, concerned insurance claims made by the Gregson Slave Trading Syndicate in Liverpool. The ship, which had begun its voyage on August 18, 1781, from Accra to Jamaica, was directed off course by its captain, Luke Collingwood, who misrecognized the port at Kingston for San Domingue, a navigational error only realized after 10 days' voyage past the intended harbor. With 4 days' worth of water rations remaining, Collingwood commanded that upwards of 130 enslaved persons be cast overboard. Collingwood, who had had no prior experience as a ship captain, had previously worked as a surgeon in West Africa, where if he deemed an enslaved body unfit for Atlantic passage, that person was killed on shore in what was considered by vesting parties to be a, quote, commercial death, whereby insurance monies could be reclaimed. Collingwood recognized that enslaved persons died aboard the Zong or on Jamaican soil, or what was then in maritime law called a natural death from starvation or dehydration, no insurance would be received. However, if the crew could argue that what was deemed in the language of the King's Bench as cargo had been destroyed intentionally to preserve a remainder, then such mass murder became insurable. And I'm spending time sort of talking about the language of this history too, because I'm trying to set up a broader argument about the language of what Sylvia Winter refers to as the human of man, particularly that language of loss, exchange, and value, and those terms that we use oftentimes to talk about extinction today, and how they have historical roots in genocide and human enslavement. Collingwood died before the ship owners went to court in Liverpool, and all logs were subsequently destroyed or lost. The only remaining documents from the history of 18th century apocalyptic terror come from the two-day legal proceedings, which, despite the protests and advocacy of Olada Equiano and Granville Sharp to make the Zong a murder trial, never left maritime court and remained a case of commercial exchange and insurance. Revamping personhood through legal discourses of exchange and commodification, which relied on the application of specific, intentionally selected words and phrasings, Gregson v. Gilbert became a pinnacle text in modern semantic constructions of man, an attempt to render illegible forms of anti-black violence underwriting the value paradigms of liberalism. Rather than disavow Gregson v. Gilbert, Philip moves within the words of the text itself, conflates and abstracts them beneath the watery worlds upon which the hold was suspended, and by which he begins to recover the stories that must yet cannot be told. The first 26 poems in the book rearrange the language of the King's Bench as a means of highlighting this recalled but never recovered loss. Each page is bordered by a list of Shona, Chui, Yoruba names, names that may or may not be those of the massacred, as no names or records of names were kept. An archive of erasure, Zong qualifies narratives of extinction, insisting on the rule of disintegrating life worlds which underwrote the Enlightenment's legislative languages of value, gain, and loss that we often use to frame stakes in our ethical arguments about the Anthropocene today. In the blank spaces between this language of the law, Philip gives us a subaltern testimony, legible to the discourse of commerce and exchange, worth and deficit, which is the language of the sea. A language of the sea, as I have already tried to suggest, is not a semiotics of words and their constituents in the world, but rather a way or a practice of reading, where waves and currents diffract and dissolve familiar letters, signs, sentence structures, and phrasings, rearranging and reassembling them into a poetics apart from recognizable linguistic codes. The voice that emerges is never entirely clear nor even translatable. Much like the ocean surface, it invites our gaze and even reflects it, but obscures that reflection in sporadic and unannounced movement, allowing no transparent look beneath. Glisson extends the metaphor. He writes, quote, "The edge of the sea represents the alternation, but one that is illegible between order and chaos. The established municipalities do their best to manage this constant movement between threatening excess and dreamy fragility." And later, "Widespread consent to these specific opacities is the most straightforward equivalent of non-barbarism. We clamor for the right to opacity for everyone." Echoing Lisson's clamor,
Philip offers a poetics of opacity, yet carefully refrains from romanticizing illegibility, as if it automatically signaled towards some pre-existent truth beyond the purview of language. Rather, by working within and not apart from the text of Gregson v. Gilbert, Philip champions an oceanic poetics capable of rendering opaque the language of the law, property, and personhood, so that new forms of relation might emerge. Philip calls the poems that follow, the first 26, quote, a translation of the opacity of those early poems, a translation that, like all good translations, has a life of its own, end quote. Within these subsequent poems, we see the language of Gregson v. Gilbert reinvented through unique dissections and rearrangements of individual words, as well as a recontextualization of those words within a mixture of different languages, all of which, as Philip notes, were used on board the Zong, including Arabic, Dutch, Fon, French, Greek, Hebrew, Italian, Latin, Portuguese, Spanish, Shona, Twi, West African Patois, and Yoruba. This unguided and uneven mixture of linguistic pairings offers a shared but not universal language, attendant to a range of diverse and distinct opacities as they relate to one another in speaking about fractured and fragmented worlds. One voice, for instance, appears to be that of a sailor complicit in the genocide, writing to a distant character named Ruth, yet simultaneously invokes the storytelling practices of a Yoruba griot, later a Shona-speaking prisoner that both calls out for water and against the terrors of drowning. An uncomfortable reassessment of Dipesh Chakrabarty's famous assertion that the Anthropocene arises from a shared sense of catastrophe, Philip's multi-voice fragmented narrative combines uneven and unequal personages into a symphonic semblance of terror that refuses to contract or condense towards any one anxiety, pathway, or event. Glissant might call this a true poetics, whose goal, he writes, is, quote, to develop everywhere in defiance of a universalizing and reductive humanism, the theory of specifically opaque structures. In a world of relation which takes over from the homogeneity of essence, to accept this opaqueness, that is, the irreducible density of the other, is to truly accomplish through diversity a human objective. Humanity is perhaps not the image of man, but today the ever-growing network of recognized opaque structures. What would it mean to attend to the lives of others, not because we locate our understanding in their vitality or suffering, nor because we are humbled by their undecipherability, but only as we hear the place of their relation in constituting and sustaining a world shared unequally, unevenly. In a poem published 55 years prior to Zong, Glissant meditates on this question, as well as the question with which I open the presentation. He writes, the ancestor speaks, it is the ocean. It is a race that washed the continents with its veil of suffering. It says this race, which is song, dew of song, and the muffled perfume in the blue of song. And its mouth is the song of all the mouths of foam. Ocean, you permit, you are accomplice, maker of the stars. How is it you do not open your wings into a voracious lung? And see, there remains only the sum of the song and the eternity of voice and childhood already of those who will inherit it. Because as far as suffering is concerned, it belongs to us all. Everyone has its vigorous sand between their teeth. The ocean is patience, its wisdom is the terror of time. The readings I've tried to outline across this short presentation clearly cannot, do not exhume lives lost within the body of the sea. They offer only another way of speaking in this world, where oceanic currents carry the recalled but not recovered voices of centuries-old cosmologies drowned in the name of a language which cannot hear them. To speak of extinction in the language of man, to name the collapse of species in the Anthropocene by the terms of value and loss, accumulation and exchange, natural and commercial death, is, as Glissant and Philip remind, always already a failed project. The sea as a poetics of recall and response offers another way of being in the world, where the struggle for species survival is not apart from, but inherited by, and integrally entangled with the spectral hauntings of past genocides left unresolved. Oceanic extinction has already occurred, relentlessly looms, and offers an ever-present now that speaks before and beyond the limits set by the language of man, demanding what Franz Fanon once famously called the reintroduction of invention into existence. Glissant asked the sea, how is it you do not open your wings into a voracious lung? To hear this lung would require a new type of language, a new way of listening, attuned to the voices of oceanic illegibility, not simply romanticizing illegibility as inherently transgressive, but rather developing a more active poetics of relation in attendance to the challenges these ruptures entail, because whether or not one hears it, the wings will open and the voracious lung project. Thank you.
Much of our kind of work of rethinking is about a kind of this project of revaluation. So I just wondered if you had any kind of reflections on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I do. And if I'm misunderstanding your question, please stop me or redirect me as needed. So a lot of this work, I think, came from broader work that I've been reading and listening to in eco-poetics more generally, which I think, as everyone seems to be very clear in their conversations and presentations, has certainly moved away from representative or aesthetic conversations about a presumed environment and more in terms of thinking about ecology as a set of relations. And so looking at lyric form and looking at experimental poetics within a text as an ecology in itself, in which words are not sort of mediating signs that are out in the world, but rather can only be interpreted in their relations to one another. And so I think in that sense, Zhong fits into this larger conversation that's happening in eco-poetics, but I think allows us to move that in a different direction, where a lot of the work in eco-poetics, I think, encouragingly celebrates this movement to ecological relationships as a way of reading. I don't think that work always necessarily thinks about the historical violence that informs ecological relationships in the first place. So there seems to be this sort of disconnect between the sea as this enmeshed site of unlocatable memory and violence, this marker which cannot be testified to the way that a gravestone or a plaque can testify, and the sea as this ecology that structures a way of reading. And so sort of my hope, or sort of my limited scope as somebody working in poetry and poetics now, is to try to think about how we can use this work that's being done on sort of ecologies of reading, but also not treat those ecologies as if they exist outside of the histories of violence which constitute them. And that's why I drew as well, too, from Sharpe's discussion of residence time, where the sea in its very composition is a marker of genocide and violence and can't be disinterred or detached from that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think I was just trying to get a sense of what the context of what the larger project of that you want to do.
Yeah.
I wondered if you were writing about anywhere Philip's performances?
Yeah, there's, and I think in the chapter version of this, I write or mention a little bit about her performances, but also the way in which this text has been written about as being taught in the classroom. So Fred Moten has an essay about teaching Zong as a symphonic experience, and the way in which Zong is not a text that can is not a text that can be sort of participated in an individual sense. Sonia Posmentier talks about sort of teaching Zong in terms of ecological relations and drawing from the performative aspects to do so. So yeah, I think there's been a kind of a range of work on this text that really tend to focus on embodied performance and the way in which the text is symphonically engaged.
Yeah. I was thinking during your talk about like if you see her perform, you know, or they are there, then there's the performance is incredibly embodied, right? Like there's this there are gongs and drums and you know and it, you feel the water in your body vibrating, right? And so it's it feels like an oceanic kind of there's this resonance happening through the group of people who are present for the performance that feels, I don't know what it means, but it's certainly active and relational.
Yeah.
In fascinating ways. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think even in the appendix to the text, if that's what they would be referred to, where Philip writes a narrative form, I think there's some really interesting essays, both by Moten and also by Evie Shockley, that would address those questions, I think, better than I could address them in any way. Sort of talking about the way in which Philip moves from the disembodiment of the lyric form, or we'd call it a lyric form, the experimental poetics that's in the first section of the book, and then the focus on the centered embodied subject that's in the notes, where Philip talks about the eye that does the research, the eye that asks these questions, mm-hmm. And the interesting sort of disjunctures there.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.